whole gun show thing to annoy me. Probably both. I find Six sitting in the penthouse's spacious living room. Her legs are tucked underneath her on a plush white couch, a cup of coffee cradled in her hands. We haven't talked much since coming back from New Mexico. I'm still not totally comfortable being around her and Sarah at the same time. I think Six might feel the same, because I definitely get the sense that she's avoiding me. Six looks up when I enter, her eyes half opened and drowsy. She looks as tired as I feel. "Hey," I say. "How was she last night?" Six shakes her head.
"She was up all night. She's just now getting some good rest."
Add Ella's nightmares to the list of problems we need to deal with. They've been a nightly thing ever since we left New Mexico. So bad that Six and Marina have been alternating sleeping in her room, trying to make sure she doesn't get too freaked out. I lower my voice.
"Does she tell you what she sees?"
"Bits and pieces," Six says. "She hasn't been real talkative, you know?"
Before New Mexico, Nine and I had visions that seemed a lot like nightmares. I say, trying to think this through.
"Eight mentioned something similar.
At first, we thought they were Cetricus Ra taunting us somehow. But they also seemed like some kind of warning. At least, that's how I thought of them. Maybe we should try figuring out what Ella's mean."
"Sure. I guess they could be some coded message,"
Six says dryly.
"But have you considered there's a simpler explanation?"
"Like what?" Six rolls her eyes.
"Like, she's a kid, John. Her Sapan just died. She was almost killed herself just a couple of days ago. And who knows what's in store for her next? Hell, I'm surprised we don't all have nightmares every freaking night."
There's a comforting thought.
"These aren't real comforting times."
Before I can reply, Eight appears on the couch next to Six. She jumps, nearly spilling her coffee, and immediately fixes Eight with a steely glare. Eight puts his hands up defensively.
"Whoa, sorry," he says. "Don't kill me." "You have got to stop doing that," Six replies, setting down her coffee.
Eight is dressed in workout clothes, his curly hair shoved underneath a fuzzy sweatband. He nods to me, then aims his most disarming smile at Six.
"Come on," Eight says. "You can take it out on me in the lecture hall."
Six stands up, pleased by the idea.
"I'm going to pummel you."
"What are you guys working on?" I ask.
"Hand to hand," answers Eight. "I figured since Six pretty much murdered me back in New Mexico." "For the last time, that was not me,"
Six interrupts, annoyed.
"The least she could do is show me some new moves so I can defend myself the next time she attacks."
Six tries to punch Eight in the arm, but he quickly teleports behind the couch.
"See?" Eight grins. "I'm already too quick for you."
Six bounds over the couch after him, and Eight sprints off towards the lecture hall. Before giving chase, Six looks back at me.
"Maybe you should try talking to Ella," Six says.
"Me?"
"Yeah,"
she replies.
"Maybe you can decide if her visions mean something, or if she's just traumatized."
As soon as Six leaves the room, there's a heavy thud on the floor behind me. I turn around to find Nine grinning at me, shirtless, just like Sarah said he'd be, gripping a sketch pad in his meaty hands. I glance up at the ceiling. "How long were you standing up there?" Nine shrugs.
"I do my best thinking upside down, dude."
"I didn't realize you did any thinking."
"Okay, fair point. You usually do enough thinking for all of us."
He thrusts the sketch pad at me.
"But check this out."
I take the sketch pad and start thumbing through the pages. They're covered with floor plans drawn in Nine's precise hand. It's like the architecture of some military base, yet it looks strangely familiar. Is this?
West Virginia,
Nine declares proudly.
Every detail I could remember. This should come in handy when we make our assault on the place. I'm sure it's where that fat jerk-off Cetricus is hiding out.
I sit down on the couch, tossing the sketch pad on the cushion next to me. When I wanted to attack the cave, you were totally against it.
That was after you'd run into a force field like a dummy,
he replies.
I said we needed numbers. We've got numbers.
Speaking of which, did you check the tablet this morning? Nine nods.
Five staying put for now.
We've been keeping an eye on our locator tablet since returning to Chicago. Five, the one guard we haven't made contact with, has been on an island off the coast of Florida for the last few days. Before we left for New Mexico, he was in Jamaica. His moving around is standard Lorik on-the-run protocol. Finding him, even with the tablet to point us in the right direction, might not be easy. Now that we've had a chance to rest up, I think we should make it a priority. The more of us, the better, right?
And maybe, while we're searching for Five, Cetricus Raw mounts a full-scale invasion of Earth.
Nine slaps the front of his sketch pad for emphasis.
We've got him on the run. We should finish it off now.
On the run? I ask, staring at Nine. That's not exactly how I remember it.
What? He did retreat, didn't he?
I shake my head. You think you're ready for a rematch?
You tell me.
Nine curls one of his arms behind him and juts the other one out overhead. A bodybuilder pose. I can't help but laugh.
I'm sure he'll be intimidated by flexing. It's more intimidating than sitting around, anyway.
Counters Nine as he flops down on the couch next to me. You really think we should go storming West Virginia after the beating we took at Dulce? Nine looks down at his fists, clenching and unclenching them, probably remembering how close he came to being finished off by Cetricus. How close we all came.
I don't know,
he says after a pause.
I just wanted to give this to you so you know it's an option, all right? You might not think I'm, like, capable of learning my limitations and shit like that, but back in New Mexico, I was maybe just slightly over my head trying to fight Cetricus alone. Six went off on her own, too. Eight got wrecked, and everyone else was getting shot up. But you kept it together, man. You kept us together. Everyone knows it. I still don't buy your bullshit about being Pittacus reincarnated or whatever. You've got that team captain vibe. So, you do the leading and I'll do the ass-kicking. It's what we're best at.
Best? I don't know. Six is pretty good at ass-kicking, too. Nine snorts.
Yeah, she was super badass in her freaking ceiling cocoon. That's not the point, Johnny. The point is, I need you to tell me what to punch. And I need you to tell me soon, or I'm gonna go stir crazy up in here.
I take another look at Nine's sketchpad. From the look of it, he probably got right to work on these drawings as soon as we returned from New Mexico. For all his bluster, at least he's been trying his best to come up with a way to take the fight to the Mogadorians. Meanwhile, I've been stuck in this rut, unable to sleep, thinking myself in circles alone on the rooftop. I wish Henri was here, I say. Or Sander. Any of the Sapons, really. Someone that could tell us what to do next.
Yeah, well, they're dead,
replies Nine bluntly.
It's up to us now, and you're always the one with the ideas. Hell, The last time I wouldn't go along with your plan, I almost had to throw you off a roof.
I'm not a Saipan.
No, but you're a freaking know-it-all.
Nine pats me hard on the back, which I've come to realize is as close as he gets to real affection.
Quit whining. Cut down on the snuggling with your little human girlfriend and come up with some brilliant plan.
A week ago, I would have bristled at Nine calling me a whiner and needling me about Sarah. Now, I know he's just trying to motivate me. This is his version of a pep talk, and, embarrassing as it is, I sort of need to hear it. What if I just don't have a plan? I ask quietly.
That, John Boy, is simply not an option.
Chapter 6. I'm back on the roof of the John Hancock Center. This time, I'm not alone. We don't have to talk about it if you aren't ready, I say gently, looking at the huddled form sitting Indian style on the roof next to me. Ella has a blanket wrapped around her shoulders, even though it isn't that cold on the roof. Somehow, she looks smaller than usual. And I wonder if stress is causing her to revert back to a younger age. Beneath the blanket, she's wearing one of Nine's old flannel shirts. It comes all the way down to her knees. Lately, it seems like the only time she's able to sleep peacefully is in the afternoons. She probably wouldn't have even gotten out of bed at all today if Marina hadn't gently prodded her to come up here and talk with me.
I'll try, she says, her voice hard to hear above the wind. Marina said you might be able to help.
Thanks, Marina, I think. I've barely spoken to Ella one-on-one since we first met in New Mexico. I guess this is a good opportunity to get to know her better, although I wish it was under better circumstances. I badly want to help her. I'm just not sure I know how. I'm hardly an expert on these visions or a psychiatrist, if that's what she needs. This is the kind of talk that would normally be left to a Saipan, but like Nine reminded me earlier, we're all out of those. I try to sound confident. Marina's right. I've had dreams before.
Dreams about him?
Ella asks. And by the way her voice drops, there can be no doubt who she's talking about. Yeah, I reply. That ugly freak has spent so much time in my head, I should be charging him rent. Ella smiles a little. She stands up, kicking some loose gravel across the roof. Tentatively, I put my hand on her shoulder. She sighs, almost like it's a relief.
It always starts the same way, Ella begins. We're back at that base. Fighting Cetricus and his minions. We're, you know, losing.
I nod. Yeah, I remember that part.
I pick up a piece of metal from the floor. I don't know what it is exactly. A broken piece of a sword, maybe. When I touch it, it starts glowing in my hand.
Wait, I say, trying to piece this part together. Is that what happened? Or is this just in the dream?
That's what happened, she says. I was scared and just grabbed the first thing I could. My big plan was to just chuck stuff at him until he stopped hitting Nine.
From where I was standing, it looked like some kind of dart, I say, remembering the fight, all the smoke and chaos. A glowing dart. I thought it was something you got from your chest.
I never had a chest, Ella replies sullenly. I guess they forgot to pack me one.
Ella, do you know what I think? I'm trying to be comforting, but the excitement is hard to keep out of my voice. I think you developed a new legacy back there, and we were all too panicked to realize it. Ella looks down at her hands.
I don't get it.
I pick up a handful of the loose stones from the roof and hold them out to her. I think you did something to that broken piece of sword. And when you hit Cetricus raw with it, you hurt him.
Oh?
She replies, not sounding at all thrilled. Do you think you could do it again? I hold the stones out towards her.
I don't want to,
she answers sharply.
It felt wrong somehow.
You were just scared. I start trying to encourage her, but when she takes a step away from me, I realize I've made a mistake. She's still shaken up by the fight, these dreams, her legacies. I let the stones drop back to the roof. We all were. It's okay. We can worry about that later. Finish telling me about the dreams. She's quiet for a moment, and I think maybe she's withdrawing completely. But after a moment, she starts again.
I throw the piece of metal at him, she says, and it sticks inside him, just like at the base. Except, in my dream, instead of retreating, Cetricus turns to face me. Everyone else, all of you guys, disappear. And it's just me and him alone in that smoky room.
Ella wraps her arms around herself, shivering.
He pulls the dart out and he smiles at me. Smiles at me with those horrible teeth. I'm stuck standing there like an idiot while he walks over and touches my face. Like caresses it with the back of his hand. His touch is ice cold. And then he talks to me.
I feel like shivering too, actually. The thought of Cetricus Ra strolling up to Ella and putting his disgusting hand on her, it turns my stomach. What does he say? I ask. She pauses, lowering her voice.
He says, there you are. And then, I've been looking for you.
And then what happens?
He gets down on his knees.
Her voice drops to a chilled whisper.
He holds one of my hands in both of his, and he asks me if I've read the letter.
What letter? Do you know what he's talking about? Ella hunches the blanket tighter around her shoulders, not looking at me.
No.
I can tell by the way she answers that Ella isn't being totally honest. There's something about this letter, whatever it might be, that's shaken her up almost as much as these visions of Cetricus Ra. From her description, I don't know if these dreams are like the ones I've had. Like the one where Cetricus showed me Sam being tortured to try baiting me into fighting him. Or if it's like Six suggested, that these nightmares are simply a result of all the really awful things Ella's been through lately. I don't want to press her any further. She already seems close to tears. I wish I could tell you I could make the dreams go away, I begin, finding myself doing my best Henri impression. But I can't. I don't know what causes them. I only know how painful they can be. Ella nods, looking disappointed.
Okay.
If you see him in a dream again, just remember, he can't hurt you. And when he tries to hold your hand, you punch him right in his ugly face. Ella cracks a smile.
I'll try.
I'm not sure if anything I said really helped Ella, but one detail from our conversation sticks with me. Whatever she hit Cetricus Ra with, I'm sure that it was the result of her developing a new legacy. She charged up that projectile and, somehow, it hurt him. Or at least distracted him enough that we were able to get our legacies back. Now I just need to convince her to try doing it again. And hopefully figure out exactly what this new legacy can do. If it worked once, maybe it will work again. If I'm going to put together a plan to finally kill Cetricus Ra, I'm going to need every weapon we have at my disposal. I head down to the lecture hall, hoping to find something in my chest, or in Nine's arsenal, that might help draw out Ella's legacy. I remember when Henri used the warming stone on me to help me first gain control of my lumen. I wonder if something like that would help Ella. I'm deep in thought when I hear the muffled sound of gunshots. I flinch automatically, hunching down, my hands growing hot as my lumen switches on. It's instinct. I know the difference between Moog blasters and Nine's gun collection, which some of the others have taken to practicing with. I also know we're safe here, at least for now. If the Moogs knew where we were, all of us together, their assault would be a hell of a lot noisier than the one gun going off. Even considering all that, my heart is still pounding, and I feel ready for a fight. I guess Ella isn't the only one jumpy from the battle in New Mexico. I push my way through the heavy double doors of the lecture hall, my hands glowing dimly because I'm still a little on edge. I'm expecting to find Nine, twirling a gun outlaw style into its holster, killing time by shooting up paper targets. Instead, I find Sarah squeezing off the last round from a small handgun. The bullet tears through the shoulder of a paper Mogadorian hanging at the far end of the room.
"Not bad,"
says Six as she pulls off a pair of noise-canceling headphones. She's standing next to Sarah, watching over her shoulder. Six uses her telekinesis to pull the paper Moog closer. Most of Sarah's shots rip through around the edges, or caught the Moog in the arms and legs. One, however, tore through right between his eyes. Sarah pokes her finger through that hole. "I can do better than this," she says.
"It's not as easy as cheerleading, huh?"
Six asks good-naturedly. Sarah unloads her spent cartridge and jams home a fresh one.
"You've obviously never tried a full layout twist." "I don't even know what that is."
Watching the scene play out, I feel suddenly and inexplicably nervous. Admittedly, there's something about her waving a gun around that makes Sarah hot in a dangerous way that I'd never really considered. But it also makes me feel guilty, like I'm the reason she's stuck here taking target practice, instead of being back in paradise, living a normal life. Plus, there's the fact that I haven't mentioned kissing Six to Sarah, or even talked about it with Six, and now here the two of them are, hanging out. I know I should come clean about that to Sarah, eventually, when she's not carrying a loaded weapon, maybe. I clear my throat, trying to sound casual.
"Hey, what's going on?"
Both girls turn around to look at me. Sarah smiles big and waves with the hand not holding the gun.
"Hey, babe," she says. "Six was just helping me learn to shoot."
"Yeah, cool. I didn't realize that's something you wanted to do."
Six gives me a strange look, like, who wouldn't want to learn to shoot? An awkward moment passes between us, where I'm feeling almost mad at her for giving Sarah this lesson without my permission. Not that Sarah needs my permission to do anything. The whole situation has me feeling flustered, and I must look it because Six eases the gun out of Sarah's hand. She clicks the safety on and holsters it.
"I think that's good for now," Six says. "Let's do some more tomorrow."
"Oh," replies Sarah, sounding disappointed.
"All right."
Six pats Sarah on the arm.
"Good shooting."
Then she fixes me with a tight smile that I'm not at all sure what to make of.
"Later, guys,"
she says, and breezes past me out the door. Sarah and I stand in silence for a moment, the lights of the lecture hall buzzing overhead. "So," I begin, awkwardly, You're being weird, she says, eyeing me, her head tilted to the side. I pick up the paper Mogadorian, examining Sarah's handiwork, while I figure out what to say. I know. Sorry. I just never took you for the armed and dangerous type. Sarah frowns at me. If I'm going to be with you, I don't want to be a damsel in distress. You're not. Come on, she snorts. Who knows how long I would have rotted in New Mexico if you hadn't shown up? And then, I mean, John, you pretty much brought me back to life. I slide my arm around her, not wanting to think about Sarah at my feet nearly dead. I'd never let anything happen to you. She shrugs me off. You can't say that for sure. You can't do everything, John. Yeah, I say. I'm starting to realize that. Sarah looks up at me. You know, I thought about calling my parents today. It's been weeks. I wanted to tell them I'm all right. That's not really a good idea. The Mogadorians or the government could be monitoring your house for phone calls. They could be tracking us. The words sound so cold, and I regret them almost right away. How quickly I'm slipping into paranoid and practical leader mode. But Sarah doesn't seem offended. In fact, it looks like it's exactly what she expected me to say. I know, she says, nodding. That's exactly what I thought. And it's why I didn't actually go through with it. I don't want to go home. I want to stay here with you guys and fight. But I don't have any Lorik superpowers. I'm just dead weight. I want to practice shooting so I can be more than that. I grab Sarah's hand. You are more than that. I need you here with me. You're pretty much the only thing keeping me from completely melting down. I get it, she says. You're going to save the freaking world, and I'm going to help you. That whole saying about behind every great man there is a great woman? I can be that for you. I just want to be a great woman with excellent aim. I can't help but laugh, the tension between us breaking. I lift Sarah's hand and kiss it. She wraps her arms around my waist and we hug. I don't know what I was so tied up in knots about. Having Sarah here just makes everything seem easier. Coming up with a battle plan to take down the Mogadorians? No problem. As for that one kiss with Six? It just doesn't seem to matter anymore. Eight teleports into the room with a puff of displaced air. He's wide-eyed and excited, but turns sheepish when he sees us. Whoa! Eight says. Sorry, I didn't expect canoodling. Sarah snickers, and I glare jokingly at Eight. This better be good. You should go to the workshop and see for yourself. I've got to go get the others. With that cryptic message, Eight teleports away. Sarah and I exchange a look, then rush out of the lecture hall and into Sanders' old workshop. Nine is already there, his arms crossed as he watches the bank of television screens on the wall. They're all tuned to the same image, a newscast from some local station in South Carolina. Nine pauses the broadcast when we enter, freezing a still image of the gray-haired anchor.
I turned on some of Sanders' old programs the other day, Nine explains. They scan news feeds for weird shit that might be Lorik-related.
Yeah, Ari had the same thing set up.
Uh-huh. Typical boring Saipan stuff, right? Except this popped up tonight.
Nine restarts the broadcast, the anchor resuming his teleprompter reading.
Authorities are at a loss to explain the vandalism of a local farmer's crops early yesterday morning. The prevailing theory is high school prank, but others have suggested.
I tune out the anchor's theories as the image switches to an overhead shot of a twisting, maze-like emblem burned into the cornfield. It might look like a juvenile prank to the newscaster, but we recognize it immediately. Burned into those crops with jagged precision is the Lorik symbol for 5. Chapter 7.
If 5's trying to find us, this is about the dumbest damn way possible,
9 says.
She could be scared and alone, counters Marina softly. On the run.
No Saipan in their right mind would go burning up crops, so they must be alone. Still.
9 trails off, his brow furrowing.
Wait. What do you mean, she? 5's a chick?
Marina rolls her eyes at Chick, then shakes her head.
I don't know, just a guess. Setting a field on fire seems like a guy thing,
6 puts in.
I remember Henri reading a story about a girl lifting a car off someone in Argentina,
I say.
We always thought that could be 5. Sounds like a tabloid story to me,
6 counters.
Guy or girl doesn't matter,
interrupts 9, waving at the computer screens.
Scared doesn't have to mean stupid.
I find myself agreeing with 9. Assuming this message is actually from 5 and not some elaborate Mogadorian trap, it's a really bad way to get our attention. Because if we noticed it, then the Mogadorians definitely did too. We've all crowded into Sanders' workshop. 9 has paused the newscast on the overhead shot of the Lorik symbol while we figure out what to do next. I have the macrocosm from my chest open, the holographic Lorik solar system floating peacefully in the space over the table.
He must not have his chest open, I say. This would change into the globe if he did.
8 stands next to me, clutching a red communication crystal he pulled from his chest. It's the same one we found in 9's and used to try sending 6 a message when she was in India.
Are you out there, 5?
8 speaks into the crystal.
If you are, you should probably stop setting things on fire.
I think he can only hear you if his chest is open, I explain. In which case, he'd show up on the macrocosm.
Ah, says 8, lowering the crystal. They couldn't have packed us cell phones?
Meanwhile, 9 has plugged our locator tablet into one of Sanders' computers. The newscast blips out of existence, replaced by a map of Earth. There's a cluster of pulsing blue dots in Chicago. That's us. Further south, there's another dot, moving extremely fast from the Carolinas towards the middle of the country. 9 looks over at me.
He's made a lot of miles since I checked on him this morning. First time he's come in from the islands, too.
6 points at the screen, tracing a line back to where the crops were burned.
It makes sense. Whoever it is, they're on the run.
They're moving really fast, though, puts in Sarah. Could they be taking a plane somewhere?
The dot on the screen suddenly takes an abrupt northward turn, crossing through Tennessee.
I don't think planes move like that, says 6, her brow furrowing. Super speed?
8 asks. We watch as the blue dot crosses right through Nashville, never slowing down or changing directions.
There's no way they just zip through a city at that speed on a straight line,
6 says.
Son of a bitch, growls 9. I think this idiot can fly.
We'll have to wait until they stop moving, I say. Maybe then they'll open their chest and we can send a message.
We'll watch in shifts. We need to get to 5 before the Moogs do. Marina volunteers to take the first shift. I linger in the workshop after the others have gone. Even with all this excitement about 5, I haven't forgotten about our other problems, specifically Ella and her nightmares.
I talked to Ella today, I begin. In her nightmares, Cetricus Ra asks her if she's opened some letter.
Any idea what that could mean?
Marina looks away from where Five's pulsing beacon cruises across Oklahoma.
Creighton's letter, maybe?
Or Sepang?
Back in India, right before he died? Creighton gave her a letter.
Marina frowns.
With everything that's happened, I almost forgot about it.
She hasn't read it? I ask, feeling a little exasperated.
We're fighting a war here. It could be important.
I don't think it's that easy for her, John,
Marina says levelly.
Those are Creighton's last words. Reading it would be like admitting that he's really gone and not coming back.
But he is gone, I reply quickly, too quickly. I pause, thinking back to when Henri was killed.
He'd been like a father to me.
And, even more than that, he was the only constant in a life spent constantly on the run. For me, the idea of Henri was almost like the idea of home. Wherever he was, that's where I was safe. Losing him was like having the world ripped out from under me. I was older than Ella when it happened, too. I shouldn't expect her to be able to just brush it off. I sit down next to Marina, sighing.
Henri, my Sepan, you left me a letter, too. He gave it to me when he was dying. You were on the road for days before I could bring myself to read it.
See? It's not so easy. Plus, if Cetricus Raj showed up in my dreams and told me to do something, I'd definitely do the opposite.
I nod. I get it. I do. She needs to grieve. I don't mean to sound heartless. When all this is over, when we win, we'll have time to mourn the people we've lost. But until then, we need to gather all the information we can and find anything that might work to our advantage. I wave my hand at the screen with Five's location.
We have to stop just waiting around for the next crisis and start acting.
Marina thinks about what I've said, gazing at the holographic macrocosm of Earth we've left open, just in case Five should open his or her chest.
This is probably what she was expecting to hear from me this morning,
when she gently asked if I had a plan for us. I didn't then, and I don't exactly now. But the first step definitely has to be figuring out what we have to work with, and Ella is the key to that.
I'll talk to Ella, she says, but I won't force her to do anything.
I hold up my hands.
I'm not asking you to.
You guys are close. Maybe you could nudge her along?
I'll try,
she says at last. Eight appears in the doorway of the workshop holding two cups of tea. Marina's face lights up when she sees him, although she quickly looks away, suddenly acting really interested in the macrocosm. I notice a blush creeping up her cheeks.
Hey, Eight says, setting down the tea. Sorry, I only made the two cups.
It's cool, I reply, catching a meaningful look from Eight that suddenly makes me feel like a third wheel. I was just leaving. I stand up, and Eight takes my seat in front of the macrocosm. Before I'm even out the door, Eight whispers some joke to Marina that immediately gets her giggling.
I've been so focused on Sarah and my agonizing battle planning that I hadn't put much thought into how much time Marina and Eight have been spending together.
That's good. All of us deserve a little happiness, considering what we're facing. It's almost dawn when Eight comes to our room, waking me and Sarah. The others are already gathered in the workshop. Six sits in front of the computers, Marina next to her.
Another brain-dead maneuver from our missing compadre,
Nine says by way of greeting. He's standing on the wall using his anti-gravity legacy. Ella is sitting Indian style on his back, wrapped up in a blanket. I arch an eyebrow at her. Did you sleep at all? don't want to,
Ella says.
She's been helping me with my strength training, announces Nine.
He hunches his shoulders, jostling Ella. She almost falls off his back, but laughs. A rare laugh. And hangs on. She slaps his back in annoyance.
Didn't even feel that.
Ignoring the others, Six turns to me.
Five stopped moving about an hour ago, then started up again.
I glance at the tablet's screen. Five's beacon has cruised along west since the last time I looked in. It now hovers around the eastern border of Arkansas.
The genius just stopped long enough to send us another message,
grouses Nine. Marina narrows her eyes at Nine.
Do we really need to be critiquing what Five does? He or she is probably alone and scared.
Honey, I spent months in a Mogadorian jail cell for my stupidity. I've earned my right to color commentate. Ow!
Ella slaps Nine on the back again, and he shuts up. I stay focused on Six in the computer screen. Just tell me what happened.
1 hour ago, this was posted in the comments section of a news story about the crops burning, says Six,
thankfully keeping it matter-of-fact. She opens up a window and drags it over to where we can all see it on the big screen. Anonymous writes, Five seeking Five. Are you out there? Need to meet. We'll be with the monsters in Arkansas. Find me.
What does it mean?
Asks Sarah.
It's like a riddle.
Six clicks open a web browser, bringing up the cheesy-looking website of something called the Boggy Creek Monster.
We found this on Google. It's a dumb little tourist attraction in Arkansas called the Monster Mart.
You think Five is headed there?
We won't know for sure until he stops moving,
Six answers, gesturing at the blue dot on the tablet.
But I'd bet yes.
Does he think the Mogadorians don't have Google?
Nine spits.
Speaking from experience, Six says, the Mogadorians monitor the internet like hawks. If we're seeing this, then you can bet they've seen it too and are trying to figure it out. They'll likely trace his IP address first and waste some time looking for his location, which is good, because we can tell from this that he's moved on from wherever he sent the message. Even so, they'll figure it out eventually.
Then we better move fast, I say.
Hell yeah!
Nine says, hopping down from the wall and catching Ella as she tumbles after him. He sets her down and cracks his knuckles.
Finally! Some freaking action!
It's like something in me clicks, and after days of overthinking our position, a plan just comes spilling out of me. Our advantage here is that we know Five's exact location. Hopefully, that gives us a head start on the Moogs. We need to be fast, and we need to be sneaky. Six and I will go to Arkansas. With her invisibility, we should be able to sneak Five out without tipping off the Mogadorians. We'll bring Bernie Kosar, too.
Oh, the dog gets to go?
Nine says flatly. His shapeshifting will make it easy for us to scout ahead, I counter. And he can make it back to you guys if something goes wrong. If we're captured, Eight, I expect to see you teleporting our violent friend Nine here into my cell within 24 hours. And if the unthinkable happens...
It won't,
Six interrupts.
We've got this.
I look around the room. Does everyone agree? Eight and Marina nod, their faces grim but confident. Ella gives me a small smile from her spot next to Marina. Nine doesn't look too thrilled about being left out of the mission, but he grunts his approval. Sarah says nothing, looking away. Good. I say. We should be back in 2 days, max. Six, get whatever you need and let's head out. It's taken a few days, but for the first time, I actually feel like a leader. Of course, that leadership feeling doesn't last all that long.
I'm back in my room, stuffing a backpack with a change of clothes and some things from my chest. My dagger, my bracelet, a healing stone. Sarah comes in carrying a holstered pistol from Nine's armory and wordlessly stuffs it in a backpack of her own, covering it with a change of clothes.
"What are you doing?"
I ask.
"I'm coming with you,"
she says, and gives me a defiant look like she's expecting an argument. I shake my head in disbelief. That wasn't the plan. Sarah shrugs her backpack on and faces me, her hands on her hips.
"Yeah? Well, it wasn't my plan to fall in love with an alien either, but sometimes plans change."
"This could be dangerous," I tell her. "We're trying to beat the Mogadorians to Five's location, but we don't know that we will for sure. We're going to have to use stealth, and Six can only turn two people invisible at once." She shrugs.
"Six says we can just bring the whatever, that stone. She can use it to copy her powers."
My eyebrows shoot up. It's a good idea. But I'm more interested in something else, she said.
"You already talked to Six?"
"Yeah, she's cool with it," Sarah replies. "She understands. There's nothing about this life that isn't dangerous anymore. I'm getting used to the idea of my boyfriend fighting an intergalactic war, but I'll never get used to just watching from the sidelines and hoping everything turns out okay."
"But it's safe on the sidelines,"
I answer weakly, even though I already know this is a losing argument.
"I'd feel safer being with you. After all, that's what happened. I don't want to be apart anymore, John. Whatever dangers you have to face, I want to be by your side."
"I don't want to be apart either, but..." Before I can mount any further protest, Sarah steps forward and shuts me up with a quick kiss. It's really not fair that she can do that during an argument.
"Just stop there," she says, smiling at me. "You've done the whole chivalrous routine, okay? It's cute, I like it, but it's not changing my mind."
I sigh. I suppose part of being a good leader is knowing when to accept defeat. I guess I should grab the Zitharis stone out of my chest, too. Nine rides the elevator down with us to the parking garage. I can tell he's still fuming, even more so now that he realizes Sarah is coming along for the mission. "We're leaving the tablet here in case something goes wrong, and you end up needing to track us," I tell Nine. Hopefully Five stays put for a while. If we can't find him once we're in Arkansas, we'll be in touch for an update.
"Yeah, yeah,"
Nine replies, shooting a sidelong look at Sarah.
"This is starting to look less like a rescue mission and more like you going on a leisurely road trip with two hot chicks,"
Nine grumbles. Sarah rolls her eyes. I glare at Nine. "It's not like that. You know we need you here in case something happens."
"Yeah, I'm backup," he snorts. "Johnny, do I have to start dating you to get some action around here?"
Sarah winks at him.
"It might help."
Nine looks me over.
"Ugh, not worth it."
Six and Bernie Kosar are already waiting for us downstairs. Nine shows us to the row reserved for Sanders' extensive car collection, eventually pulling the tarp off a silver Honda Civic. It's the least flashy vehicle left in Sanders' collection. We don't want to be attracting any unnecessary attention while we're on the road. BK immediately bounds into the passenger seat, excited to get going.
"It's fast,"
Nine explains.
"Sander outfitted all of these cars in case we needed to move ass in a hurry."
"Does it have nitrous?"
Sarah asks.
"What do you know about nitrous, sweetheart?"
Nine replies. Sarah shrugs.
"I've seen Fast and Furious. Show me how it works. I've always wanted to drive something really fast."
"Well, all right,"
says Nine, grinning at me.
"Maybe your girl does have some uses, John Boy."
While Nine shows Sarah the controls inside the Civic, I join Six at the trunk.
where we load our gear.
I'm still feeling blindsided that Sarah's coming along with us, and apparently, I've got Six to blame for that.
"You're mad at me?"
she says, before I can even start in. "I'd appreciate a heads up the next time you invite my girlfriend along on a dangerous mission."
Six groans, slamming the trunk closed and rounding on me.
"Oh, please, John. She wanted to come along. She can think for herself."
"I know she can," I whisper back, not wanting Sarah to overhear. "Nine wanted to come along, too. We have to consider what's best for the group."
"You don't want her feeling like dead weight, do you? This is a good way to show her that she's not."
"Wait, dead weight?"
I think back to my conversation with Sarah in the lecture hall. Those were the exact words she used.
"Were you eavesdropping on us?"
Six looks a little guilty at being busted. But more than anything, she looks increasingly angry with me, her eyes flashing.
"So what? I thought you might finally grow a pair and tell her that we kissed." "Why would I do that?"
I snap, struggling to keep my voice low.
"Because the longer you put it off, the more awkward it gets, and I'm getting sick of it. Because she deserves..."
Before Six can finish, the Civic roars to life, Sarah revving the engine. Nine steps back from the driver's side window, looking pleased with the way Sarah's gunning it. Sarah leans out the window, peering back at Six and me.
"You two coming, or what?"
Chapter 8. The penthouse feels even larger as soon as John, Six, and Sarah are gone. I'm still not over the size of this place. It's almost big enough to contain the entire monastery of Santa Teresa. I know it's silly, but I find myself tiptoeing through it, feeling like I'm constantly disturbing these riches Nine and his Seipan amassed. The tiles in Nine's bathroom are heated. They actually warm and dry your feet when you get out of the shower. I think of all the times I sat on my mattress, picking splinters out of my feet after crossing the uneven wood floors of Santa Teresa. I wonder what Hector would think of this place, and I smile. Then I wonder what kind of person I would be if my Seipan had been Sander instead of Adelina, a showy but dedicated guardian, frivolous in his purchases, but not one to abandon his duties. It's pointless to think such thoughts, yet I can't help it. But if I hadn't been stuck so long in Santa Teresa, I never would have crossed paths with Ella. I never would have journeyed to the mountains with Six and met Eight. All the hardship, in the end, was worth it. I stifle a yawn with the back of my hand. None of us got much sleep last night, not with the excitement of finding number 5. It was supposed to be my night sleeping in Ella's room, shaking her awake when the nightmares got too bad. Actually, I don't think Ella slept a wink in between the meeting and tagging along with Nine during his shift, watching 5's beacon. Apparently, to her, spending time with Nine is better than getting some rest. I wish I knew how to help, but my healing legacy doesn't extend to the dream world. I find Ella curled up in a chair in the penthouse living room. Nine stretched out on the nearest couch, snoring loudly, his hands curled around the contracted metal tube that turns into the staff I've seen him use with such deadly efficiency. He must have gotten it from his chest when he still thought there was a chance John would bring him along on the mission. Nine clutches the weapon like a teddy bear, probably dreaming of killing Mogadorians. "You should get some sleep, too," I whisper. Ella looks from me to the sleeping Nine. "He said he was just going to rest his eyes and then he'd show me some ass-kicking techniques." I giggle. There's something hilarious about Ella parroting Nine's language. "Come on. There will be time for training later." Nine grumbles something in his sleep and rolls over, burying his face in the couch cushions. Ella stands up slowly, and we tiptoe out of the room. "I like Nine," she announces as we walk down the hall. He doesn't care about stuff. My brow furrows. What do you mean? He never asks me how I'm doing or, like, worries about me. He just makes gross jokes and lets me walk on his shoulders across the ceiling. I laugh, but I feel a bit wounded. All of us have been so worried about Ella, always trying to get her to open up about Creighton. I'm still supposed to do what John asked and get to the bottom of that letter. And along comes Nine, taking her mind off her troubles with bluster. We're just worried about you, I say. I know, Ella replies. It just feels better not to think about it sometimes. Maybe this is a good time to give Ella that gentle nudge John was talking about. My Saipan, Adelina, she spent a long time trying not to think about her destiny, about our destiny. But eventually she didn't have a choice. She had to face it. Ella doesn't say anything, but I can tell by the way her face is scrunched up that she's thinking about my words. I find myself detouring away from the bedrooms and instead heading back into Sandor's workshop. I stand over the plugged-in tablet, watching the dots that represent 4 and 6 crawl slowly towards 5 stationary dot in Arkansas. Are you worried about them? Ella asks. A little, I reply, although I know the others will be fine. Even after meeting 9, 6 is still the toughest and bravest person I've ever met. And 4 is everything 6 said he would be. A good guy. The leader we need. Even if sometimes I can tell he feels like he's in over his head. I hope 5 is a boy, announces Ella. There aren't enough boys for all of us. My mouth hangs open for a moment, and then I start to laugh. Are you matching us up already, Ella? She nods, looking at me mischievously. There's John and Sarah, of course, and you and 8. Wait a second, I say. Nothing's happening with me and 8. Shh, interrupts Ella, continuing on. And if I grow up to marry 9, who does that leave for 6? Who's getting married now? 8's standing in the doorway behind us, that charming smirk of his lighting up his face. How long has he been standing there? Ella and I exchange a surprised look and start laughing. Fine, says 8, sidling over to gaze at the tablet. Don't tell me. Our shoulders brush when he gets close, and I don't move away. I still think about that desperate kiss we shared in New Mexico. It was probably the boldest move of my entire life. Much as I'd like to, we haven't kissed again since. We've talked a lot, sharing stories about our years on the run, comparing the fragments of our memories of Lorien. The time just hasn't felt right for anything more. They're really taking their time, huh? 8 says, watching 4 and 6 move south. It's a long drive, I reply. Good, he says, grinning. That should give us some time. 8's wearing a red and black t-shirt for something called the Chicago Bulls and a pair of blue jeans. He steps back and gestures at his wardrobe like he's asking Ella and me for our approval. Do I look American enough in this? Are you sure we should be doing this? I'm feeling nervous as the elevator glides down from the penthouse to the lobby. 8 stands next to me, practically bouncing with excitement. We've been here for days and still haven't actually seen the city, he says. I'd like to see more of America than military bases and apartments. But what if something happens while we're away? We'll be back before they even make it to Arkansas. Nothing's going to happen on the drive down there. If it does, Ella can use her whole telepathy thing and call us back. I think about 9, who was still sound asleep on the couch when 8 and I crept past him. Ella watched us go, smiling conspiratorially at me, while she curled back up in her chair next to Nine. Won't Nine be